Hello and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle Radio. Each week, the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in finance take you beyond the numbers and hype, right to the heart of the big issues of the day. This week, we're looking ahead and diving into the Q2 outlook published by those clever folks in the UBS Global Wealth Management Chief Investment Office. We have three of their number joining us this week to unpack the main findings. They're going to explain why the outlook for the second quarter of 2024 focuses on the topics of technology, durable income, and risk management. So let's jump in. First up, we're joined by Kiran Ganesh, Bulletin regular and Managing Director in the UBS CIO, and one of the editors-in-chief of The Outlook. Kiran, a warm welcome, as always. Now, as one of the minds behind the piece, and before we hear a bit more from you about risk management, just start off by giving us a sense of the frames of reference that you and your colleagues have in mind when you put this report together.
Yeah, so we like to think about what are some of the key questions and issues that our clients are asking us. And this particular quarter, those are very much focused around the theme of technology and how to invest in the AI trend, given that this has been a really big driver of markets over the course of the past few months. Secondly, income, because there are lots of questions about the future path for interest rates and how clients can generate not only income, but also durable income. And then finally, as you mentioned, that question of risk management, because clients are certainly conscious that equity markets have increased in value quite substantially over the past few months. And there are various geopolitical and political risks on the horizon. So certainly questions about how to manage that are in the forefront of clients' minds. So they're really very much driven by the kind of questions and interests that's coming from our clients.
Well, let's jump into that point about risk management. As you said, you've got lots of sort of equity benchmarks at or close to all-time highs. I imagine some people might say, well, look, you know, is this the time to stay away, take my profits out, move out to the sidelines? But I know that's not necessarily a sensible idea. And there's this interesting idea about some kind of new principles, this idea of getting in balance, which I thought was really interesting. Tell us a bit about that.
Yes. So I think the challenge with trying to look at the levels of markets and then decide when to invest is, of course, that it's quite unclear exactly how quickly some trends like AI might get priced into markets. You know, it's entirely possible that a lot of the future gains that we would expect to see from AI get front-loaded into markets over the next 1 to 2 years. You know, equally, we could, of course, see a hype cycle and a bubble and potentially a crash, and then maybe the gains only come later. But that's really, really hard to call. So, you know, we tend to advise investors to make sure that they are, you know, staying invested, getting invested, and being positioned for those longer term trends. Now, of course, that brings the question of, well, how much to invest? Clearly, it may not make sense to have an entire portfolio positioned for a trend like artificial intelligence. And that is where we come back to this theme of balance. And we think that that's particularly important for investors to consider right now, because we've seen, you know, such a big rally in some of these companies related to AI and technology that it's been quite easy for portfolios to fall out of balance, and something which may not have had a big allocation to AI maybe a few months ago now may have a big allocation to AI because those stocks have done so well. So that question of just making sure that clients have exposure to trends like technology, equity markets, but also balance that out with some opportunities outside of tech and also some other asset classes like bonds and alternatives, we think is just something that clients should be taking the time to review at the end of the first quarter.
And let me ask you here, Kiran, about the D word, diversification, because we often return to that as a theme. And I know that diversifying with alts is an interesting tool at people's disposal this time. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of areas that people can think about when they're looking at alternatives. So the first is to think about alternatives as a different way to play some of the trends that they might otherwise play through public markets. So again, taking technology as an example, and there are of course many great listed technology firms that people can invest in, but also many technology companies do stay private and are privately funded, and then getting access to those growth trends will require investors to look at alternative assets like private equity or private debt, and so that they can get some exposure to, you know, some of those companies that may not be listed on public markets. So an alternative growth driver is one way to think about it. And then the other way to think about it is as portfolio diversification, because you can get access through alternatives to certain asset classes and asset types which just aren't readily available on exchanges. So thinking about things like infrastructure, private debt, private lending, certain hedge fund strategies, you know, these aren't things that you can readily invest in through public markets, and they often have return profiles which are diverse compared to public markets. So by adding some exposure to these areas, investors can get more different return drivers within their portfolio, and that can help steady returns in portfolios over time. So, you know, we think certainly an interesting trend to, you know, diversify sources of growth, but also diversify sources of return.
Kieran, just one kind of aside that I wanted to ask you about in terms of risk management. Again, another thing we've discussed often is the difficulty of pricing in political volatility or uncertainty into any kind of strategy. And just with the US election, it's this sort of elephant in the room, isn't it? You know, towards the end of the year, the world's biggest economy. Just an aside that, again, this idea of taking a long-term view, not being rash or not rushing, not trying to game scenarios predicated on a political outcome. Again, I know this is not necessarily in the second quarter. It's an H2 thing, but an interesting aside just to note that people need to, as with this, with everything else, stick to their principles.
Yes, because the challenge with trying to position portfolios based on an expected outcome of an election is twofold, really. One, you have to get the results of the election right, and I think it's far from clear today which way that might go. And secondly, you have to get the consequences right. I think it's worth remembering that when President Biden won the election in 2020, many people thought that that would be, you know, a big boon for perhaps green energy stocks. And indeed, he introduced a number of policies which were quite supportive for renewable energy. But actually, those companies underperformed over the subsequent months and years due to, you know, some other factors. And, you know, equally, you know, people often have the idea that perhaps defense companies may perform better or worse under a Republican or Democrat administration. But often the realities tend to be quite different. So overall, we think that this is just too complex an issue to get right, or certainly too complex an issue to put too much weight on when managing a portfolio. And we think that the best thing to do is, as you said, stick to your principles, think about your long-term goals, align your portfolio with those, and then hold on for the longer term. And then, you know, of course, you can make some tactical adjustments as policies become clearer and maybe some of the facts on the ground change. But trying to anticipate that ahead of the election, we think, is not advisable.
Kieran Ganesh. Well, Kieran mentioned income and tech in the mix there. So let's take a deeper dive into those areas next up. First, in terms of fixed income, we're joined now by Fred Mellers, Head of Global Fixed Income Strategies in the CIO at UBS Global Wealth Management. Fred, welcome to the show. Look, the outlook pieces are such a useful tool to make sense of a volatile and often unpredictable world. I ask Kieran this too, though, Fred. Before we get into the detail, what are some of the frames of reference you and your colleagues use when setting the agenda here?
My focus is on fixed income. And as a bank, for a number of months now, we've had a very constructive view on fixed income as an asset class. It's been a key recommendation for our clients and a position we have had within our discretionary mandates. Now, in regards to your question, obviously, in terms of prospective fixed income returns, one of the key metrics that we focus on is central bank policy. And central banks over the last number of years have obviously done a lot of rate hikes, given the inflation backdrop that we had coming out of the pandemic. And that was obviously a huge headwind for fixed income returns. But last year, we started to see some pretty clear signs that inflation was trending lower. And that was opening up the prospects of central banks ending their rate hiking cycle and beginning to start discussing rate cuts. So at the moment, the biggest focus for us has been on the US Federal Reserve, given they are the most influential central bank for interest rate markets. And the debate has been around the timing and magnitude of the first rate cuts from the US Fed. Now, our investment view has been a little bit challenged in recent weeks because we've just seen some consecutive very high inflation prints. So although, as I said earlier, we've seen some pretty good disinflation from the peaks over the last 18 months, the last 3 months, we've started to see a bit of a stalling in the disinflationary process. And that has raised the question as to whether the Fed can actually proceed with rate cuts. And that's created volatility in fixed income markets.
Yeah, that's interesting. So I guess then from a sort of investor point of view, I don't know, is it a bit more attractive to be looking to maybe lock in yields because of that backdrop that you've described? How else might we think about benefiting from that backdrop? And I guess we come back to something we often cover on this program, which is the importance of maintaining a diversified portfolio, which I guess, again, helps in this instance.
Sure, sure. So look, we've had a bit of a backup in interest rates over the last 2 weeks. So from a pure tactical perspective, we would say now is actually a pretty good time to lock in some of these yields, particularly in the higher quality parts of fixed income. But I think as the saying goes, sometimes it's not always about market timing. It's time in the market that matters. And, you know, unfortunately, we don't have the crystal ball. So what we've been recommending to our clients who are maybe a little bit overinvested in cash, and it's made perfect sense because for the first time in a long time, you've been getting paid just sit on cash, and you don't obviously get mark-to-market volatility when you're sitting on cash. But we've been saying, look, if you've got excess cash, taking a little bit of that out of your money market funds, or if you have some fixed-term deposits that are coming up to maturity, and reallocating that into the fixed income market, particularly the higher quality parts of fixed income, we think makes perfect sense. Because if central banks do start the rate cutting cycle, and we have seen that here in Switzerland, the SNB is the first G10 central bank to start cutting rates, and we are quite confident that the ECB will follow in June, what will happen is those returns that clients have been earning on their cash are going to come down quite rapidly. Whereas locking in yields in fixed income, I think, ensure that for a much longer time frame, you can be still generating some pretty healthy yield.
Let's talk a little bit about, more broadly, I guess, about actively managed fixed income strategies, because I think that's another kind of interesting point to reflect on that was highlighted in the Q2 outlook.
Okay, so in terms of active fixed income, there's things you can always do on the rate side. There's also things you can do in the credit space. And then I'd say inflation is also a sort of sub-asset class of fixed income. So in terms of the rate space, we are recommending taking a little bit of long duration positioning at the moment. So that means if you have a duration target, given the level of rates at the moment and the prospects for rate cuts down the line, we think running a little bit of a long position makes perfect sense from a tactical asset allocation point of view. Then, of course, that raises the question as to where along the curve do you want to take that active duration positioning? And we think the five-year part of the curve is the sweet spot. So it's a little bit technical, but when you think about a yield curve, it's obviously a forward expectation of policy rates. So where the market thinks that the Fed or the ECB or the Bank of England, for that matter, are going to take policy rates into the future. So the bond market tries to price these expectations. And the reason we like the five-year part of the curve is because it captures some of the short-term policy rate expectations. So what the market thinks the Fed or Bank of England or whichever central bank is going to do in the very near term, but also where they may end up taking interest rates into the future. And this is what's referred to as the equilibrium policy rate or the neutral policy rate. Now, this is quite academic. It's very hard to know what neutral policy rates are or should be, but the bond market tries to price this. And at the moment, when we look at the five-year part of the curve, we'd say that the implied neutral policy rates are quite elevated. So this is why we think there's an opportunity in the five-year part of the curve. And once rate cutting cycles commence, you often see the five-year part of the curve outperform the rest of the curve. So this is an active strategy we're running at the moment. We also think curve steepness makes sense because as central banks start cutting rates, curves tend to steepen. But there is another dimension to why we like curves at the moment. And that's linked to the fact that, you know, many governments at the moment, specifically the United States government, have been running very large deficits and have increased the amount of debt that they have outstanding. And there are signs from time to time that the bond market gets a little bit uncomfortable with the amount of supply coming from governments, and you get indigestion. And what happens is you get term premia coming back into the curve, which results in bear steepening as well. So this is why we're sort of recommending steepness at the moment. On the credit side, we, as I sort of touched on earlier, we do have an up in quality bias in credit. So actively, you can manage across the different credit segments and credit quality. So for instance, you can position around investment grade, high yield, EM loans. Then of course, you can position around the various rating bands within those segments. The short story for us is that we like up in quality. There is more yield as you go lower down the quality spectrum. But at the moment, we've seen spreads tighten quite significantly. And we think you don't need to be a hero in these markets at the moment. We think giving up a little bit of yield and moving up in quality makes much more sense. And lastly, I touched on inflation. So inflation-linked bonds are a key subsector of fixed income. And obviously, you can take positions around inflation expectations. At the moment, we'd say break-even inflation rates, which are a measure of inflation expectations, look fair to maybe a little bit rich. So we're not overly constructive on inflation-linked bonds relative to nominal bonds at the moment.
Fred Mellors. Well, finally, let's hear from a returning regular to the show, Sundeep Gantori. Sundeep's an equity strategist covering global tech at UBS Global Wealth Management, CIO. Sundeep, it's great to talk to you again. And we're going to be talking about the tech picture, AI, of course, looming large. And before maybe we look at the Q2 outlook, let's take a step back and look at Q1. A few learnings so far. What have been the main headlines, particularly in that AI space? So many media headlines, of course, continue to be published about AI. But what are your key takeaways so far as you look back on the first quarter?
So it's been a pretty good quarter for tech globally, as you pointed out, mostly driven by AI. So we believe there were five defining moments for AI in first quarter 2024. Obviously, the first one is we have the first $2 trillion AI company in the form of NVIDIA. But if I read between the lines, it's not just NVIDIA, but any segment that is exposed to AI, like semiconductors or companies like software, have done very well. And then obviously the companies that are disrupted by AI, like hardware and also IT services, were the most, or the segments that underperformed. We expect this trend should continue. We continue to like semiconductors and software. One may argue that, you know, valuations have gone up, but actually the upside was mostly driven by positive EPS revisions. And clearly, you know, across the market, numbers have been revised down. So my second defining moment was basically strong fundamental growth revisions for AI. Third, we clearly see broadening of AI customers and demand trends. So just to give you some context, it's not just the big tech companies or enterprises, banks, retail companies that are investing in AI, but sovereign countries, governments are investing, countries like Sweden, Japan, you know, Singapore, actually aggressively investing in AI. That brings us to the fourth defining moment, where after ChatGPT, you know, we have seen some innovation which was more evolutionary last year, but now we have more revolutionary AI products in the form of, for example, software engineering tools, which now can do even 15 or 20% of the, you know, typical tasks which a software engineer can do. So there's a massive productivity jump. Of course, new chips and also many such applications. And finally, the fifth defining moment for us is massive investments in the unlisted space. So far, the wealth has been concentrated by listed companies, but we now see a lot of investments into venture capital, private equity. And interestingly, big tech are leading. Normally expect VC funds, but this time around, actually, big tech companies are investing. So these, for me, are the five defining moments for AI in first quarter.
Well, that's really interesting. And there's obviously so many seams of opportunity from an investment point of view, just in what you've described there, Sandeep. Just tell me, I guess we're kind of past the tipping point, aren't we? The inflection point was long ago. Investors just cannot afford to be underinvested in this space. So just before we move on and look at maybe some more detail about the outlook, in broad strokes, what is the way to ensure, not as a big institutional investor, but maybe as an individual investor, that you can optimize your exposure to these areas of tech?
Sure. So, and as I mentioned, the best ways to play AI is clearly the two industries, semiconductors and software. Despite the recent outperformance, we continue to like them. But on top of that, we also believe, as I pointed out, demand is broadening. So we have identified $5 trillion AI opportunities that investors can look at. The first one, obviously, AI GPUs. So each of these $1 trillion opportunities means companies exposed to these segments can have a valuation or a market cap potential, potentially combined market cap potential of more than $1 trillion, some cases even $2 or $3 trillion. So the first segment is AI GPUs. So clearly demand should continue to stay strong there. Second, we believe that custom chips. So while GPUs will maintain the dominant market share, I think we are seeing a trend of companies trying to develop the custom chips. And we believe the foundries, the company that manufactures, also stand to benefit. So that's number two. Number three, we believe that the semicap equipment, which has been a laggard, we think that massive investments will happen. And as you can see in the next 1 to 2 months, and also with the recent grants in the US, we are seeing companies actually expanding their footprint. So semicap equipment is a $3 trillion opportunity. Fourth, obviously, AI software. For us, software is a potential theme to look at within AI in second half with more, you know, innovation coming. And last but not the least, AI unicorns. So we got almost 180 unicorns in AI space and the number is rising. So we believe these are the five ways investors can optimize and also look for opportunities within AI beyond the semis or even software as industries.
Well, let's, Sandeep, look at Q2 then, the outlook. That's what we're here to discuss. A few really interesting frames of reference, but give us a quick sketch. What are the key things you're looking out for as we're now embarked upon that second quarter as we head towards H2? What's front of mind?
Right. So I think what we are closely monitoring clearly is A, the innovation that I mentioned earlier, and that pace should accelerate. So that for me, that's a key factor I would monitor. Second, somewhat linked to monetization, I mean, massive investments should continue. But at the end of the day, you know, investors would ask, show me the money, right? How do I actually monetize? The good news is companies are making money, but of course, you have to justify those billions, hundreds of billions of dollars of investment. So we would rather wait and see more details, as you pointed out, in second half, where not just software, but increasing cloud monetization, and also potentially how companies try to bring that cost. Because not every company might be investing in AI to introduce a new, you know, stream of revenues or service. But as long as they can optimize and bring costs down, I think some companies are fine with that. So at the end of the day, whether you introduce new revenue category or maybe bring your costs down, I think we need more tangible examples of that. And finally, obviously, regulations is something we would definitely monitor, particularly with the elections in the US and also many countries around the world. Don't underestimate the risk around regulations. We think regulations, there will be a fine balance between regulations and innovation. But again, given how much some of these share prices have gone up, don't underestimate the risk if at all there is any big regulation around data privacy or in the way companies can use the data in terms of training. That is also something we would definitely monitor closely.
Sandeep Gantori. And that brings us to the end of this edition of the programme. You can listen again and explore more at monocle.com. You can also follow the show wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget, you can discover more and find out how UBS can help you at ubs.com. This is The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle Radio. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks for listening.